This is J.G. Hertzler, General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Season 7, Episode 19 of Commentary, Trek Stars, a show which deals with the work of Star Trek creators outside of Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today is part two in our series on Justin Lin, where we're going to be looking at the second movie that he directed, for all practical purposes, Annapolis. All right. Annapolis.
Yeah. Annapolis.
Now, this is a movie which was released in January of 2006. It stars James Franco, Tyrese Gibson, and Jordana Brewster. The funny thing about that being that, you know, much like John Cho Better Luck Tomorrow and Star Trek Beyond, Tyrese Gibson and Jordana Brewster are both people who at this point had been in Fast and Furious movies which were not directed by Justin Lin, and they would later go on to work with them, with him,
yeah,
in later installments. So, coincidence.
Very cool.
Yeah.
They could probably recommend him after their pleasant experience creating the cinematic experience known as Annapolis.
I'm sure that's what happened.
Yeah.
So, it actually probably didn't happen because the first Fast
and
Furious...
I was just kidding.
No.
I know. Like that.
Yeah. But thinking about it, like, this is kind of interesting because Fast and the Furious Tokyo Drift came out like less than 5 months after this movie. So, he had to make that one very quickly and very angrily.
Very quickly and I look forward to seeing it. I like speed and I like anger. So there you go.
Have you watched, just as a teaser, have you watched The Fast and the Furious or Too Fast, Too Furious yet?
No, I have not.
Okay.
I will get to them. I'm doing things from there to here. I'm revisiting some animated series episodes, and as soon as I have that block over with and the crying stops, I will go ahead and go into watching the Fast and Furious movies.
Fair enough. If you are looking to cheat it a little bit in terms of time, you could skip over Too Fast, Too Furious and watch that after number three.
I know. Yeah, I had somebody try to tell me that it technically takes blah, blah, blah. Like, they tried to explain something, and I was like, I haven't even watched the movie. Why are you bothering with this? So,
yeah.
But that's what people do.
All I'm saying is that there's really nothing in Too Fast, Too Furious, which there is literally nothing in Too Fast, Too Furious, which is addressed in the third movie. So
no, I got a commute, and I'm looking forward to pulling this up on my iPad.
Nice, yeah. 21st century, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah, right? In traffic, watching a Fast and Furious movie. Watch out, y'all. I will not be the one driving. I'll just safety first.
Well, that's good. That's good.
Yeah.
All right, so yes, Annapolis. Okay.
Yes.
So basically, yeah, this is like, let's say, 3 years after Better Luck Tomorrow was released, and, you know, Hollywood came calling, apparently, and Justin Lin gets to do a big budget movie for Disney, and it's very Disney in a lot of ways. Do you want to give a synopsis of Annapolis?
Sure. I will. I honestly think that the best way you can kind of classify this is a movie in the same vein. It's not necessarily the same structure or anything. It's in the same vein as Backdraft, where the protagonist, by the time the movie's done, I often feel like the goal is you're supposed to stand up, and at the end of Backdraft, you stood up and you're like, yeah, I want to be a firefighter. And at the end of this, you're supposed to stand up and go, yeah, I want to go join the Navy. Because, you know, it's all about digging deep and finding your dream and finding the courage to pursue it, even though everybody's against you and even though all of the odds are stacked against you, you can make it happen in the armed forces.
Yeah. Yeah. Basically, James Franco is a guy whose dad is a lifelong shipbuilder in the Navy shipyards or whatever. and he's mm-hmm. following in his dad's footsteps, but his dream and his mom's dream for him, his dead mom's dream mm-hmm. for him, is to go to the academy and become yeah. a naval officer. And after much whatever, Donnie Wahlberg is like, I'm gonna give this guy a chance.
Yeah.
And he lets him into the academy, and then mm-hmm. he...
Would you dare say that Donnie Wahlberg saw that he had the right stuff? Just throwing it out there?
Potentially, yes.
Okay.
So, you know, James Franco trying to do his thing, and along the way he meets various people and has various struggles.
Yes.
And tries to make it... It's basically about his first year at the academy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a thrill ride, because he's brought in as a boxer, and he finds that his experience boxing will philosophically lend assistance to him in terms of the journey that he's on.
Yeah.
It's very central to the entire film.
In a lot of ways, it's kind of a boxing movie, more than a military movie. You know,
by the end, it sort of turns into Apollo versus Rocky.
Yeah.
Like, pretty much literally. Like, you know, that's what it turns into, which is, you know, not a knock. I mean, it's, you know, Lynn does a decent job of keeping things moving. And, you know, I was actually, you know, because watching it in the context of we watched Better Luck Tomorrow and now we see this, like, you can see growth in terms of the camera movement. Like, he's given more money, he's given more equipment, you know, a more powerful cast, so to speak, and he puts it to good use. Like, you know, the characters are fairly well drawn, you know, and sympathetic. He gets good performances from people, and you know, he does a good job with this.
Yeah, he does an okay job. I guess I wasn't as impressed with his growth as you were. You know, to me, in a lot of ways, I see this as kind of being a step back creatively for him, because mm-hmm. in the last movie, I think that since it was sort of an indie film and everything, he was, you know, going for broke, and he didn't really have anyone telling him what not to do, in a sense, if that
sure.
makes any sense. And,
yeah.
you know, I think that it's interesting looking at this one where, you know, he's given more money, and that means more responsibility, certainly, you know, financially and everything. And I think he becomes a little scared, you know, and he's not willing to experiment nearly as much as he did on the first movie. And this becomes much more standard in a lot of ways.
I don't see the thing is I don't disagree. My statement simply has to do with, like, not in terms like Better Luck Tomorrow. I agree with you. Artistically is more satisfying. There's no doubt. And when you watch this movie, you know that Lynn has basically been given a job where it's like, here is the story. Here is what you're going to do. James Franco is your star, and make him look good and make everything work. Mm-hmm. And so I think by those criteria, it's not as artistically satisfying as Better Luck Tomorrow, but you can tell that it's somebody who recognizes that this is his opportunity to prove that he can work with a bigger, you know, like it, that's sort of the spirit in which I mean it. Like, he does what he's supposed to do with a movie like this, which is create something that by the end, Navy, James Franco realized his dream. That's it.
Yeah.
And, so, yeah, it's not as artistically satisfying, but he's still, I still see somebody who, given the additional, he doesn't crack under the pressure like, what's the name of the guy that did the Fantastic Four movie?
Josh Trank.
Josh Trank snaps when somebody gives him that responsibility and they say, do this, it's paint by numbers, you just got to get them from A to B to C mm-hmm. and finish the movie. Lynn comes in and, okay, I need to go A to B to C and finish the movie, and he does it.
Yeah.
And he does it competently.
Yeah, no, that's true. It kind of proves that he can be a studio director, in a sense.
Right.
You know, which is what he has essentially become as we look forward at the rest of his career. There's really only one indie left that we have to watch, and all the rest of them are big budget, you know, studio films, much bigger than this one, you know.
Yeah.
Even. So in general, what were your thoughts on Annapolis?
I mean, it's didn't set me on fire, but I didn't regret seeing it. I mean, there were a couple of parts where, I mean, it is so honestly paint by numbers. You know each story beat that's coming before it happens. You know what's going to happen. You know what's lurking around the corner. But so long as you accept that and you're just willing to accept that, I mean, I think that there are some standout performances in it, actually, for what the material is. I forget the actor's name, but the roommate who stays with him when everybody wants to kick him out, and he says, "I'm Arkansas and you're Mississippi, because so long as Mississippi is there, Arkansas doesn't look so bad." That guy that sticks with him through the whole thing, even though he's given a story moment that is very awkward at the end, like that felt like it. I don't want to go full spoiler, but you know the moment I'm talking about, I think, mm-hmm. where that character does something where you're like, wait, what? That came out of left field. They didn't need that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, that's a good performance. He got I think, you know, I really liked Jordana Brewster. I really liked Franco in this. I thought Franco did a good job.
Yeah, Franco wasn't bad. Yeah, I think everyone was pretty decent. The name of that actor is I'm probably going to butcher this name, but Vasselis Rion Shannon, who is probably best known as the kid in The Hurricane.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah. He's pretty good, and also just to note here, as far as, you know, Star Trek connections are concerned, the superintendent or whoever it is of the Academy, mm-hmm. is played by Charles Napier, who has been in a million things like Silence of the Lambs and whatnot, but he was also one of the space hippies on the original series.
That's right, he was. You're absolutely right.
And now
he played
the
space guitar.
Oh my God. Now he's in the Navy. His space hippie self would be so disappointed in his
Navy superintendent. So let's tie it into Star Trek continuity. Yeah.
Okay.
Space hippie is his far in the future descendant, because he's so moved by James Franco rebelling against the system and still succeeding that he decides that his grandson is going to go down a different path, and it sparks this whole different path that eventually leads to space hippies.
Oh, okay. See, I was going to go with his great grandson was just rebelling against his, you know, naval upbringing or whatever.
Okay.
And decided to become a space hippie.
Well, and maybe part of the family stayed in what became Starfleet.
Yeah, maybe.
So there you go. We've got a family drama in Star Trek hidden somewhere in this story.
Yep, for sure. You know, I thought that this movie was pretty good. I mean, you look at the reviews, and the reviews are epically bad. You know, like 10% on Rotten Tomatoes bad.
I don't think that's fair.
No, I don't think it's fair either. I think that this is actually a pretty decent movie. I definitely think it's one of Lynn's lesser works, you know, and like you're saying, it is very paint by numbers. You know exactly what's going to happen every step of the way. Extremely cliche, but the cliches work. You know, they're effective. One of the things which I found interesting is that in a lot of ways, it's kind of similar to Star Trek 09, or the beginning of Star Trek 09, at least, you know, where Kirk, you know, for example, is a kid living in a town where they build starships, and then someone sees something in his abilities or whatever, and even though he's like a townie, literally, you know, they you know, get him to enlist in the Academy, and he goes and succeeds against all odds.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay. Yeah, I can see that. I can totally see that. And then he's later on the ship that was being built at the beginning of the movie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, it's a weird thing, because growing up, you know, as a kid who was a huge Star Trek fan who knew absolutely nothing about the military aside from my grandfather's love for the Marine Corps, which he was a member of during World War II. And I didn't really have any sort of like knowledge of the military or how it worked, aside from what I saw on Star Trek. And because of sort of wanting to expand my knowledge on how like this universe works and how this, system works.
Yeah.
Like growing up as like a junior high school student, I actually like did a lot of sort of like research into the Navy in particular, just to kind of see how it works, because there is definitely a parallel there between that and Starfleet Academy in terms of just the general structure and that kind of thing.
Well, sure. I mean, and Nick Meyer brought in a lot of real naval tradition in Star Trek too.
Right. Right.
So straight up to every officer called Mister, regardless of sex.
That's from the Navy?
That's old school Navy.
Okay.
Yeah.
See, I didn't know that. I thought that was always just like them saying like, look, we're progressive.
No, the rule was, because the thing is, of course, women were not always serving in the military.
Uh-huh.
It was just tradition that it would have been Mr. Savick.
Interesting.
Instead of Lieutenant Savick. And just when women came in, it's like the military is honestly as much as it can be about efficiency. And why would they change their rules? It's like, women are here now. Okay, that's still Mr. Savick. That's fine.
I'm going to a screening of Wrath of Khan in a couple of days, and there's like a critic, whatever, talk afterwards, and I'm sure that's inevitably going to come up because it always comes up.
It always comes up.
Now I'm going to blow their minds with the reason behind it. Yes.
Do it. Do it. No, the thing is, for my family, there's tons of people who went. I didn't go through any military academies or anything, but my dad was former Marine Corps. His dad was Army in World War II, Marine Corps before that. I had an uncle who, I have several uncles who've gone through the Navy, and I have cousins who've gone through the Navy. The military runs strong in my bloodline. So it's got to be weird sometimes, I think, to watch a movie like watching Star Trek, like that is so not really military. It's not a very good military structure.
I can imagine. I can imagine.
Which I suppose is a statement because they're supposed to be explorers.
Yeah.
Not a fighting force.
They try to make the point that it's not military except when someone didn't get the memo or when they need to make it military for whatever story they happen to be telling. But to me, I mean, like, it always worked best as sort of like even if they weren't, fighting, having that sort of like military structure, seems to work best, as far as, Starfleet is concerned. And, the interesting thing to me about this coming at it from that perspective is, if you're going to use the Navy as, an analogy for Starfleet Academy or whatever, if you're going to go backwards with it, then obviously, I'm sorry, for Starfleet, then obviously, Annapolis is Starfleet Academy,
Yeah. And the thing is, I'll be interested to see if he has an opportunity or if Lynn decides on some level to take what he obviously had to study for this movie and bring it into Star Trek. And we see, like when Meyer came on, a little bit more of that more regimented feel to the command structure.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if not, I don't think he's going to make a naval recruitment movie, but something that echoes, he spent time doing his research for this, and he'll bring some of that knowledge forward.
Yeah. 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 I'll be curious. I mean, I highly doubt that we're going to get to see Starfleet Academy in this new movie. It sounds like it really is going to be out there.
Oh, sure. But I mean, in terms of the way people interact on a crew.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cause there was virtually no sort of military echoes at all in Abrams's two takes on it. Like, everything was very lateral. There was no real hierarchy to the command structure.
Yeah.
So I just wonder if Lynn will come in and transfer that over. Who knows?
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see for sure.
Yeah.
So what about the accuracy of this movie?
Well, I reached out to one of my cousins who had gone through the Naval Academy, and what I found was, first and foremost, that when I said I was watching Annapolis, she her reply was, "Ha ha, yeah, that's an entertaining movie." And I was like, "Go on, please fill me in." And the thing is, I had specific questions about the fraternization between Jordana Brewster and James Franco, and she was like, "Yeah, no, that doesn't. They'd both be kicked out for that. That's done. That's not going to happen."
It almost seemed like in the movie, it almost seemed like they were like, you know, "Oh, well, you know, you're not a plebe anymore, so it's okay."
Nope.
Yeah.
No. Not at all. Not at all.
Yeah.
And I asked about, I know that the rule used to be that you had to, because he goes on break at one point and he like just saunters into town and he's just in his scruffy clothes again and everything.
Yeah.
There are rules for people who are plebes and youngsters when they go into town. They have to be in uniform. They can change into uniform into their civvies when they get to their host house or their sponsor's house, I should say. And as far as drinking, you just had to be over 21. So the fact that he's drinking in public while he's attending the academy, he would have had to have been over 21, which you can sort of skirt around and say, well, he was a last-minute addition. He didn't go through the typical sort of process. Because typically, to get into the Naval Academy, you have to go through a whole thing where you pass a physical test and you also get a sponsor letter, typically from a representative or a senator or somebody like that. Somebody has to sponsor you to, you know, and write a letter of recommendation for you along with your grades and everything, which is why the one roommate, where it was such a big deal for him to get into the academy. The one thing is, yes, there are people who aren't in tremendous physical shape when they get to the academy. They have a ways to go, but there's still a minimum bar that they're going to have. And he didn't seem to meet that minimum bar that would have been required of somebody coming into the Naval Academy. So that's something that's sort of in that it needed to be that way for the plot.
Mm-hmm.
But like it would have been nice for them to work in something about like maybe a little backsliding when after he got accepted or something like that.
Yeah, it seemed a bit exaggerated.
Yeah, it was definitely a bit exaggerated.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't knock this movie as terrible in terms of the accuracy. Oh, there's no boxing tournament either.
Really?
There's no way they're going to let you come in and start wailing on a commanding officer. That ain't going to happen.
See, that's something which I kind of assumed was a real thing because,
no.
I mean, because again, you know, all my knowledge of the military I get from science fiction or from talking to Brandon.
Sure.
Because he was in the Navy.
Okay.
But, you know, on Battlestar Galactica, there's that whole boxing tournament episode.
No, it might be different when you get out there, when you're out of the academy. When you're in the academy, there apparently, when my cousin was there, it was like a boxing. It was similar to a boxing tournament, but it was two classmates could fight. They would have classmates do fights, but it was under. It was almost although this will carry a negative connotation. It was in a very sort of. As I understand it, as it was explained to me, it's almost like a frat hazing sort of fight.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're not trying to kill each other and they're not trying to knock each other out. It's like just a fun fight for them to get into.
Yeah.
So, but apparently it was, in my cousin's words, quote unquote, insane to watch.
Okay.
So
right.
I'm sure there were some ruffians there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And everything.
I'm guessing that, yeah, probably the boxing tournaments like this, I mean, yeah, like on ships, I guess that would make more sense, you know, sort of that sort of thing, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, everybody's out of the academy and there's, I think there's a different set of rules when you're actually out at sea with somebody for a long time. I didn't ask about that.
Yeah.
But in terms of the academy, no, you're not going to be, You're not going to be given the opportunity to punch your CEO.
Yeah.
No.
That's interesting still, you know. I mean, I'm assuming that they, I mean, I don't know for sure, but I'm guessing that they probably had the cooperation of the Navy when they were making this movie.
Oh, I'm sure they did.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the Navy gave cooperation to Top Gun. Why wouldn't they give it cooperation to this?
Gave it to Transformers, so, yeah.
Yes, they did, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I think what we're saying is that the Navy's film division is not exactly rigorous in the movies that it chooses to participate in.
Yeah, it basically it's like, are you? Is your movie going to get people to want to join the Navy? Yeah? Yeah. All right.
Does your picture portray the Navy as the sum of all evil and a bad place to go? No? Great. Go ahead. We'll help you out.
Yep. For sure. Yeah. All right. Well, any final thoughts on Annapolis?
Yeah, it's worth seeing. You know, I mean, it's not great, but it was on Amazon. I don't know. It was like $3 or something.
Mm-hmm.
You've done worse things with your time. It's definitely not a 10%er. It's not something where I'd be like, you got to run out and see Annapolis, but it's all right. It's not bad.
Yeah. It's a decent movie. It's, Disney, technically it was Touchstone, which is owned by Disney, but they've sort of cornered the market on this type of movie. You know, I mean, like Backdraft, that's okay. Mm-hmm. That's an okay example, which is a Touchstone movie, things like, a lot of sports movies, actually, like Glory Road and The Rookie, right? Miracle, mm-hmm. It feels like one of those movies,
Yeah.
This sort of like, come on, this is, and it's not like that's one of the weird things about this movie is like there really are no stakes in the sort of dramatic sense,
mm-hmm.
where like it's more about like these guys and their time at the Academy and how do you have like a climax to that, because it's not like they're like, and now for your final test you will go out to sea and into battle, no, that's not anywhere on the table, right? So mm-hmm. how do you have sort of like a final conflict in a story like this, and you do it as a boxing match, and it's like, okay, yep. Well, that's, and I kind of like that, the idea that it's not life and death, it's a military story where it's not life and death. It's about being in the military. It's not about like being in combat. You know what I mean?
Right.
And that I thought was pretty cool, and on the whole I think it is done pretty well, even if it is rather cliche and rather inaccurate at times. And yeah, I would recommend it too. It's not gonna blow you away. It's not some sort of transcendent, filmmaking experience or anything like that. And it's not one of Justin Lin's best movies, but it's, decently made. You know? Yeah.
Yeah, I think you said it best. He proved that he could operate in a studio system.
Yeah, and going forward, we're going to get to see him get to do some crazy stuff, starting with next week as we venture into the Fast and the Furious franchise, which quickly became his to own.
Can't wait.
I can't wait either. Honestly, I'm really looking forward to rewatching these movies. So it'll be fun.
All right.
All right, so we've got a bunch of news this week that we thought we would touch on with various creators and whatnot. Some good news, some bad news, and yep. I guess we'll start with the bad news, but the biggest news, at least in my opinion, and that is that Gary Hutzel passed away. For those people who don't know, Gary Hutzel was a visual effects supervisor who worked on the first 5 seasons of Next Gen before moving over to DS9 and working on the entire run of DS9. After that, he worked on a bunch of television shows, most notably Battlestar Galactica, where he was like the in charge. He was the guy. He was the guy who did the visual effects on Battlestar Galactica. Nominated for 20 Emmys, 20 Emmys, yeah.
Good grief.
Won 4 of them, including 2 for work on Star Trek. 1 for the Next Generation episode, Conundrum. That's the one they wake up and they're like, who are we? Yeah. You know? And there's like the other guy there. So he won the Emmy for that. And then he also won the Emmy for Emissary, the first episode of DS9.
Which is funny. I remember seeing a behind-the-scenes featurette somewhere along the way, and I believe he would have been the one talking about it, where they talked about how they filmed explosions so that they looked like they exploded correctly for space. And I remember being very much younger, and it was a behind-the-scenes sort of thing. It was something they were showing on PBS or something. I don't know where they were showing it. But they showed how they would set the camera up on the floor, point it upward, so that when it exploded, everything would explode outward toward the camera because this is the best way to give it the sense of weightlessness. I was like, blew my mind when I was younger. I was like, oh my gosh, that's brilliant.
Yeah, I had a similar experience watching some Star Wars behind the scenes video where they showed that same thing. Yeah, it's cool. It's cool for sure.
It is.
He also won Emmys for 2 episodes of Battlestar Galactica, Exodus Part 2, and He That Believeth in Me.
I don't know the show titles for Battlestar Galactica. So
Exodus Part 2 is the one where they leave New Caprica.
Oh gosh, that is a great when Galactica's coming down through the clouds and all the flames and the ships are flying out. Yeah,
exactly.
That is a hell of a sequence.
Yeah,
yeah.
And then He That Believeth in Me is the first episode of season 4. So that would have been the one where they came back and Right after the one where I'm not going to say anything about it because it's going to spoil like one of the best things, like the one right after they reveal who the final 5 are. So
anyway,
okay. Other things that he was nominated for, I mean, just so that you know, if anyone wants to do a Gary Hutzel marathon, for Next Gen, he was nominated for Tin Man.
Oh wow.
Best of Both Worlds Part 1 and Part 2.
Deservedly so.
For Deep Space Nine, Way of the Warrior.
Yes.
Trials and Tribulations.
Oh my. How did he not win for that?
I know, some of these, it's like, what?
How on earth do you not win for Trials and Tribulations?
Yeah. How do you not win for Best of Both Worlds, either part?
Yeah.
You know, like, what was he
I have to go look up what he was up against because good grief.
Yeah.
You got to be kidding me.
One Little Ship. That's the one with the, you know, where they shrink.
Oh, yeah.
And What You Leave Behind, the finale. Yeah.
Oh, I can't even think about that show without crying.
The other BSG shows that he was nominated for, the very first episode, you know, night one of the miniseries. The Hand of God. I'm not sure which one that is. 33, which was the first episode.
Oh,
that
won a Hugo Award for writing, didn't it?
Yeah, I'm sure it did.
Yeah.
Resurrection Ship Part 2.
Okay.
Daybreak Part 2, the finale, you know?
Okay.
And then he was also nominated for Blood and Chrome. And then he was nominated for Virtuality, which we did an episode on. That was the Ron Moore show where it was basically like... I think as the title of our episode describes it, a malfunctioning holodeck of the series.
Yes. Yeah.
And an episode of Caprica, There Is Another Sky, and then the pilot for Defiance, which came out a couple of years ago.
He was kind of young too, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was only 60.
Yeesh.
It was very, very sudden and yeah.
I mean, honestly, any time is too young when you really look at it on a long enough time frame, but man, 60, that's a shame, man. That's a shame.
It is. And I mean, like you think like, okay, so he did visual effects, you know, whatever, you know, but I mean, God, I mean, you're talking about like Exodus Part 2, right? Like that sequence, right? Where the ship jumps into the upper atmosphere and then is just falling as all the vipers are shooting out of it, and then it jumps back out right before it hits the ground.
It's insane.
It is insane. And, you know, you can say, well, you know, I think it was actually Weddle and Thompson who wrote that episode. They had to write it, and then I think it's Felix Alcala directed it. You know, he had to direct it. He had to come up with these shots or whatever. But ultimately, Hutzel is the one who actually had to do it, right?
He sold it.
Yeah. And I mean, when that moment, like there are moments, I know it was like, I don't even remember why we were talking about this before. I was talking about how like I cried in Dark Knight Rises and some other movie, and I forget what the other movie was, you know, but there are moments where I'm like so moved by like the artistry of something.
Oh, sure.
Where it's like, you know, chills like run down your spine. I mean, like Mad Max Fury Road, right? I mean, like that sequence where the bikes are jumping over the truck and throwing bombs on it. I mean, there are moments in there where I'm just like, oh my God, you know, and it like literally like moves me to tears, right? Yeah. And that scene in Exodus Part 2, that like moved me to tears because I was just so impressed with the artistry on display. You know,
I can say no lie that the reason I earlier was able to recall that sequence is because I had started going a little cold on the show by that point.
Mm-hmm.
And then that episode happened. And in specific, that was the moment where for the first time that entire season, like I sat up and out loud went, man, whoa. Like, cause you're right. Like it just blows your mind what you're watching. You're like, this is amazing.
I'm going to find it. Like I did a random search on YouTube, you know, last night because I have all the discs on Blu-ray and stuff like that. And I was thinking about like rewatching it, but I was like, I don't have the time to rewatch the whole thing, but I just thought I'd see like, maybe there would be something on YouTube where it was like a clip and someone had put together like 5 minutes of basically just the battle sequence from that episode, right?
Oh wow.
And they took out all of the there's like only like two shots of actual like people. The rest is just CGI ships doing their thing, and they took out all of the sound and just put it to music. And
That's got to be amazing.
What it is, what it really did, and I'm so glad that I found it, because basically what it does is it takes, like, by taking it completely out of context, all that you're seeing, like, literally all that you're seeing for, like, 5 minutes are what it was exactly that Gary Hutzel did, you know, what he did on that show. Like, this is, you know, I would say probably his masterpiece, right? And it was just like the most beautiful thing that I've seen. I'll put a link to it up on the Babel conference, but it's just so amazing, you know? And it's really sad that he's gone because.
And the thing is, this is the one thing I'm going to say, is that one of the things that always makes me so happy, even in a moment like this, where it's like, oh, we lost somebody, but something that always makes me so happy as a Star Trek fan, and in particular being on this show with you, is I struggle to think of a fan base that is more aware of the artists behind the scenes as the Star Trek fan base can be.
Yeah, that's true.
Like even though Star Wars fans can acknowledge it, they know that it's there, but like when Gary Hutzel goes, like we pause and we remember and we know what he contributed. Like that's sort of a beautiful thing. Like I think that people should recognize that that's actually a pretty special thing about being a Star Trek fan, is that there is just this extreme respect for everybody that works on it, not just the actors or writers or directors, but everybody that gave something.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's definitely true. Yeah. So go off and watch Exodus Part 2 and Emissary, and go check out Gary Hutzel's work, and he'll be missed for sure. So
definitely.
Okay, on to some better news.
Yeah.
Hey, there's two more executive producers on this new Star Trek show.
There sure are,
and they are people who. I think Star Trek fans will be familiar with, and that's Rod Roddenberry and Trevor Roth.
There you go.
So Rod Roddenberry, of course, is Gene Roddenberry's son, and he runs, you know, Roddenberry Entertainment. Is that what it's called?
Yeah, I think so. And we were talking about, you know, on the other side of things, we were talking about the fine shirts that we both bought for Star Trek Into Darkness.
Oh, yeah.
To our viewings.
The black shirt with the black Delta Shield on it. I have that. I also have a, when the first picture, when Justin Lin tweeted the first picture from the Beyond set, and it was a shot of the jacket with the little Starfleet logo on it, and they took that logo and put it on a shirt, you know?
There you go.
So I of course, I, you know, had to get that shirt, you know?
It's kind of a must-have.
So yeah, they're going to be executive producers on this new show. Now, I mean, executive producer can mean a million and one things, everything from, you know, they're running the show, running the writer's room and the day-to-day operations of this series to, you know, they're contractually obligated to have this title for some reason or another. And who knows exactly why Rod Roddenberry and Trevor Roth are executive producers, but my guess would be that they want to bring in the Roddenberry company as sort of a partner in this endeavor.
Sure.
Which I think is completely reasonable and kind of really cool.
I completely agree. I mean, it's like the whole, you know, bringing in Nick Meyer and stuff like that. Like that, Rod Roddenberry being brought on board is just yet another sign that CBS has taken this really seriously. Mm-hmm. And they really want to get, they're crossing every T and dotting every I.
And Roddenberry, of course, is really good in terms of interacting with the fans and everything. And they have like a strong presence at conventions and stuff like that. In fact, they're going to be at a convention here in Chicago in, next week, a week from today when this thing is being released. And that's the C2E2 which they're the same guys who run the convention in New York. That's going to be the Star Trek convention. That's going to be in New York, by the way. So I'm excited. I'm going. You know, I'm excited to see the Roddenberry booth and see what they're doing. If they say anything or whatever, who knows? You know, but it's cool that they're involved. You know, because it shows to me that CBS, like you're saying, is taking into account all of these different perspectives, you know, and this is certainly one which is important to be involved with. So yeah, it's cool.
It just feels right that a Roddenberry's involved.
For sure. Yeah. And for the record, you know, because I mean, this is something that they made on their own, you know, both Roddenberry and Roth were producers on the documentary Trek Nation, which was about Rod Roddenberry's quest, I guess you could say, to find out, you know, who his dad was and why people love him, you know, the way that they do, you know, that sort of thing. Have you seen it?
I have not seen it.
It's really good, you know?
Okay.
Yeah, Rod Roddenberry hosts it, you know, and goes around and interviews people like J.J. Abrams and George Lucas and, you know, all these other various people, as well as, like, you know, personal, you know, connections to Roddenberry and stuff like that, and tries to figure it all out. And it's really, really good and informative and touching, and I highly recommend it. I think it's been on Netflix in the past. I don't know if it is.
Who can guess the ebb and flow of Netflix anymore?
I know, it's crazy. But hey, Blade Runner is on Netflix, so you know who's complaining.
Yeah, that kind of blew my mind. That was actually, I pulled up Netflix for the kids to watch one of their Disney shows or whatever, and like the cover for Blade Runner was there, and I was like, oh, cool. And I think it was my 7-year-old was like, what's that movie? It's for grown-ups, honey. What happens in it? Trust me, honey, just don't click play on that one.
I would have been like, I know you guys really want to watch Frozen again, but let's try something new. No.
If you social services picks up your kids if you show them Blade Runner and they're less than 10 years old, I'm guessing on that one, but that's not going to go over well.
Okay, all right. So maybe they can't watch Blade Runner yet, but
no.
Here's something which, you know, I think you will be able to share with them, which is coming up hopefully in the not-too-distant future, and that's a new television show on WGN America called Scalped.
You were talking to me about this. What is that about again? What that, is it family friendly?
It's about, you know, well, okay, here it is. It's based on a comic book.
Okay, that's good territory to start from.
DC sure. comic. DC comic.
Okay. DC comic. The Batman and Superman. Okay, superheroes. All right.
I mean, it's in the Vertigo line, you know, which is where the adult, you know, like Sandman.
We're moving into the gray area here.
You know, but for network television, I'm assuming they'll have to tone it down a little bit.
Probably a touch.
Okay.
Although Hannibal was on network television. I'll just point
true.
That one out.
That's true. Yes. It's about, you know, I've actually read this comic, which is kind of crazy. I read it for back before Commentary Track Stars. Brandon and I started up a podcast which lasted two episodes called Captain Snafu and Mr. Chestile Area Show. Which
rolls off the tongue.
Easy oh, they were both nicknames which were given to us when we would hang out at the comic book store, and
okay.
you know, we thought we would do a little news and, you know, like you know, review like a comic or a movie or something each week. And,
sure, sure.
And Brandon, who's much more in touch with comic books than I am, was like, "There's this comic book called Scalped, and it's really good. So how about you read that, and then we can talk about it." And I'm like, "Okay."
Is it about selling tickets to concerts? What's it about?
It's about, well, it's basically kind of, I mean, I think the thing that lots of people, the way that lots of people describe it is it's kind of like Goodfellas, like on a Native American reservation, you know?
Definitely doesn't sound family friendly at that okay. point. Well, but it does have my interest. So it's like Goodfellas on a Native American reservation.
Yeah.
I kind of dig that concept. That sounds interesting.
Yeah. You know, I kind of dug the concept too. I didn't particularly like the comic, but mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that a television show about it won't be good. And to be fair, a lot of people love the comic. It was written by Jason Aaron, who is now mm-hmm. the guy writing the Star Wars comics for Marvel. You know,
and he's doing a great job.
He is doing a great job. And this new show... The reason why we're talking about this random show, which may or may not be on TV in, you know, a year or so, is because the new show is being created by Doug Jung, who is the co-writer of Star Trek Beyond.
Probably if Beyond is a big hit, it will definitely make it to air.
Let's hope so, you know.
I'm willing to bet.
Yeah.
From the writer of Star Trek Beyond.
Exactly, exactly.
There you go.
So, you know, hey, something to look forward to for sure. It's exciting stuff. The irony of ironies for me, at least, is that it's going to be on WGN America. And mm-hmm. WGN, of course, is a Chicago-based network,
yeah.
you know, going back to the radio days. You know, I always walk by the WGN, you know, radio building when I'm downtown and everything like that. You can see them, you know, on the air as they're, you know, broadcasting in their big windows, which they always make a point of being bulletproof glass.
Chicago's a nice town is what you're saying?
Okay. You know, whatever. But the thing about it is WGN America is their superstation, you know? So like WGN is just Channel 9 here, right? And we've got like the CW on there and lots of baseball games and everything. But then there's the superstation, which is used for, you know, nationwide broadcasts, right? And like Salem, for example, Brandon Braga's show is on the superstation. But since we here in Chicago have just plain old regular WGN, mm-hmm. we do not get the superstation. So even though WGN, a Chicago-based network, is branching off into all this crazy stuff like Scalped, we can't watch it here in Chicago.
That makes no sense.
It makes
whatsoever.
Absolutely no sense. It became an issue when Salem was on because we reviewed Salem for this show, I had to get it off of iTunes in order to see it.
How does that even work? Why wouldn't they show it there?
I have no idea.
doesn't make any sense at all. That's got to be some sort of like screwy FCC thing.
I don't know. I mean, maybe they've changed it now. Maybe like the network has picked up the other I don't know, or the cable company. But
yeah,
back when Scalped came out, yeah, we could not watch it here in Chicago. It's crazy.
Crazy. Crazy.
Anyway, hopefully they'll have it all worked out in time for Scalped. So.
Yeah, well, on a long enough timeline, probably WGN will be airing it on their pay app by the time it comes out.
This is true. This is true.
Yeah.
All right. One other thing real quickly. If you are downloading this on the day that we release it, or, you know, any time after that, really, 10 Cloverfield Lane is now in theaters. You know,
oh, that's right.
J.J. Abrams production. So
yes,
be sure to go ahead and check that out. I'm going to be seeing it in a few days, and I'm super excited. So, yeah. Okay. Well, it's been fun talking about Annapolis today, but that's not all we're talking about here on Trek FM this week, so here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
You've heard Chief Trip sign on. I'm serious, Ken, actually, out of the chair, please.
Okay. God.
I guess the Commodore has the con!
To the journey! All right, next one is from Damian Haywood, and Damian, come on. Which Voyager crew member would you hate to be stuck in the Delta Flyer with? He's always so negative. I called him on this the other day. I said, Damian, why always with the negativity? He said, at least I'm consistent. The 602 Club.
We start getting hints of Thor. We start getting hints of Cap. We start getting hints of the entire Avengers crew, and we get Black Widow. So, I mean, Iron Man 2, considering how maybe that's not my favorite movie of the MCU, really does set up a lot of what is to come.
Literary Treks.
You know, visually to me, this is one of my favorite eras of Star Trek. You know, those monster maroon coats they're wearing, and they're just absolutely gorgeous. And, you know, a lot of people talked about wanting to get a Captain Sulu Star Trek series, and one of the big reasons for me that would be so great is to see this era played out visually on a regular basis.
Women at Warp.
Her voice as a computer voice has become so iconic that when Google started developing what is now known as Google Now, that personal assistant you can speak to, they had initially codenamed it Google Majel.
That's so cool.
Isn't that awesome?
Meta Treks.
And I kind of had the jingle in my head, you can be a winner at the game yes. of life. And I was trying to think of the Star Trek version of that. You know, you can be a winner of the poker game of life on the Enterprise. It didn't really roll off the tongue, so.
It was great until you added on the Enterprise.
Melodic Treks.
The reason why I think Brian Reitzel would be a more plausible choice is because he has worked with Fuller in the past. They worked together on Hannibal. He scored that series, all 39 episodes. The neat thing about Brian Reitzel's music is it's more of a sound design than it is a score.
Saturday Morning Trek.
One of the characters is sizably larger than the other. So
he's just closer to the camera, Aaron, obviously.
But he's actually behind the other person.
He's a giant.
Wait, then he doesn't need a laser cutter. He can just lift the hatch up with it. Go down together.
Okay. Continuing mission.
Yeah, and of course, another great thing is when it's all finished and you look at it and go, yeah, we made that together. Yeah, that's one of the greatest moments. And people respond to it and say, oh, that's pretty well made. The effects are great. The actors are great, even though they're Dutch trying to speak English, right?
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to help find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link as well. If you want to help support the network, you can go to our store. Just type trek.fm/store into your search thingy and it'll pop right up. because that's the actual address. And they'll take you to our Redbubble store where you can buy lots of t-shirts, sweatshirts, pillows, whatever you want, you know, with cool designs on them.
Yes. Many cool designs, but Citizen Kane, we await.
One day, you know.
One day.
Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. If you want to leave us a review on iTunes, we would definitely appreciate that. That helps us gain visibility on the app or whatever it is.
Helps other people find the show.
Helps other people find the show, you know, which is good for everybody. So, feel free to leave a rating and a review, and we'll read your review on the air. All right, if you want to contact us, you can fill out the form on trek.fm/contact, or you can leave us a voicemail by going to speakpipe.com/trekfm. On Twitter, you can find the network at trekfm. On Facebook, you can find the network at facebook.com/trekfm. Facebook is also where you'll find the Babel Conference, which is the listener forum, where I'll put up that video with the footage from Gary Hutzel's work on Exodus Part 2. Just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook or go to our website at trek.fm and click the discussion tab on the menu bar. Before we go, we'd like to ask everyone to please support our sponsor, who helps us bring commentary, Trek Stars, and all of our shows to you each week. And our sponsor for this show is Audible.com. Audible is a great way for you to read all of the books you've always wanted to read but never thought you'd have the time for. John, do you have a book for us this week?
Do I? I have Horatio Nelson, The Leaders series, written by Molly Hardwick and narrated by John Graham with a full cast. It's dramatized. And since we're on a naval bend with this specific show, Captain Nelson is a little man who cannot boast of being handsome, but who will, in my view, one day astonish the world. So said Sir William Hamilton to his wife Emma when Captain Nelson first sailed into Naples Bay in 1793. Even that shrewd ambassador could hardly have guessed how great the little man would become. So get some naval history.
Sounds good. Yeah, there's one scene in Annapolis where they're like, who were the first three admirals? And they were like, someone in Farragut. And I'm like, oh, Farragut. Now it all makes sense.
You're kidding. You didn't know?
I don't know. I had heard of the Dewey guy before, but, you know.
He did a decimal system, right?
I think he did, right? Yeah. I do come from, like, you know how you come from a family of, like, you know, naval officers and whatnot? That's me, but with librarians.
Wow.
Yeah.
That would have been a heck of a pickup football game we could have played.
This is true. Yeah. Anyway, as a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice along with a 30-day trial to see how great Audible is. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm. And we thank Audible for supporting Commentary, Trek Stars, and the network. All right. Well, that takes care of Annapolis. You know, we got those first two Justin Lin movies out of the way, and now the real game begins. You love Batman Forever.
Oh, who could hate Batman Forever? Nobody could hate that. You'd have to have a heart of stone.
I used to have, it was my favorite t-shirt. It was the logo from Batman Forever, where it's the bat symbol inside the question mark. And I'm like,
it's beautiful logo.
I loved it.
That logo is not the problem with that movie.
And, you know, I wore that shirt until it was disintegrated into nothing. Well, I just noticed on the Warner Brothers store, you can now buy it. They make it to order. I'm totally getting that shirt.
Buying them in bulk, aren't you?
I might just buy. So I've done that before. One. Like when Target started selling Mr. Pibb t-shirts, I did buy three because I knew that I would need them.
In for a penny, in for a pound, huh, Mike?
That's why you always see me wearing Mr. Pibb t-shirts, and it's like, wow, he wears that shirt a lot. It's like, no, I've
You're
actually
like
got
Fry with Slurm.
Three of them, you know?
It's the same thing.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I mean, Mr. Pibb.
I can't wait until they have
the
golden bottle cap and a Pibb can.
It's the best. It's the best. R.I.P. Mr. Pibb. Hasn't been made since 2001, but what can you do? Anyway, never forget. So next week, we will be back to talk about Justin Lin's third movie and the third film in the Fast and Furious franchise, The Fast and the Furious, Tokyo Drift.